don't want to be a lawyer." He'd misread my intent, but I didn't say so. This was as riveting a secret as he'd ever revealed to me.
Not a lawyer?
I've never wanted to be a lawyer. It goes against my nature.
He gave me a tired smile.
You should be the lawyer. Father said you would be the greatest in South Carolina. Do you remember?
I remembered the way one remembers the sun, the moon, and the stars hanging in the sky. The world seemed to rush toward me, sheened and beautiful. I looked at Thomas and felt confirmed in my destiny. I had an ally, a true, unbending ally. Running his hands through the waves of his hair, torrential like father's, Thomas began to pace the length of the piazza.
"I want to be a minister," he said. "I'm less than a year from following John to Yale, and I'm treated as if I can't think for myself. Father believes I don't know my own mind, but I do know."
"He won't allow you to study theology?"
"I begged for his blessing last evening, and he refused. I said, 'Don't you care that it's God's own call I wish to answer?' And do you know what he said to that?"
"Until God informs me of this call, you will study the law."
Thomas plopped into a chair, and I went and knelt before him, pressing my cheek against the back of his hand. His knuckles were prickly with heat bumps and hair. I said, "If I could, I would do anything to help you." As the sun lowered over the back lot, Hetty was still nowhere to be seen. Unable to contain my fears any longer, I planted myself outside the window of the kitchen house, where the female slaves always congregated after the last meal of the day. The kitchen house was their sanctum. Here they told stories and gossiped and carried on their secret life. At times, they would break into song, their tunes sailing across the yard and slipping into the house. My favorite was a chant that grew rowdier as it went.
"Bread done broken, let my Jesus go. Feet be tired, let my Jesus go. Back be aching, let my Jesus go. Teeth done fell out, let my Jesus go. Rump be dragging, let my Jesus go."
Their laughter would ring out abruptly, a sound mother welcomed.
"Our slaves are happy," she would boast.
It never occurred to her their gaiety wasn't contentment, but survival. On this evening, though, the kitchen house was wrapped in a pall. Heat and smoke from the oven glugged out the window, reddening my face and neck. I caught glimpses of Aunt Sister, Benna, Cindy, Mariah, Phoebe, and Lucy in their calico dresses, but heard only the clunk of cast-iron pots. Finally, Benna's voice carried to me.
"You mean to say she ain't eat all day?"
"Not one thing," Aunt Sister said.
"Well, I ain't eatin' neither if they strap me up like they done her," Phoebe said.
A cold swell began in my stomach.
Strapped her up? Who?
Not Hetty, surely.
What'd she think would happen if she pilfered like that?
I believed that voice to be Cindy's.
What'd she say for herself?
Aunt Sister spoke again.
"She won't talk. Handful up there in bed with her, talking for both of them."
"Poor Charlotte," said Benna.
"Charlotte? They'd strapped her up. What did that mean?" Rosetta's melodic keening rose in my memory. I saw them bind her hands. I saw the cowhide split her back and the blood flowers open and die on her skin. I don't remember returning to the house, only that I was suddenly in the warming kitchen, ransacking the locked cupboard where Mother kept her curatives. Having unlocked it often to retrieve a bromide for Father, I easily found the key and removed the blue bottle of liniment oil and a jar of sweet balm tea. Into the tea I dropped 2 grains of laudanum. As I stuffed them into a basket, Mother entered the corridor.
"What, pray tell, are you doing?"
I threw the question back at her.
"What did you do?"
"Young lady,
hold your tongue."
"Hold my tongue?" I'd held the poor tortured thing the near whole of my life.
"What did you do?"
I said again, almost shouting. She drew her lips tight and yanked the basket from my arm. An unknown ferocity took me over. I wrenched the basket back from her and strode toward the door.
"You will not set foot from this house," she ordered. "I forbid it."
I stepped through the back door into the soft gloom, into the terror and thrill of defiance. The sky had gone cobalt. Wind was coursing in hard from the harbor. Mother followed me, shrieking,
"I forbid it!"
Her words flapped off on the breezes, past the oak branches, over the brick fence. Behind us, shoes scraped on the kitchen house porch, and turning, we saw Aunt Sister, Benna, Cindy, all of them shadowed in the billowy dark, looking at us. Mother stood white-faced on the porch steps.
"I'm going to see about Charlotte,"
I said. The words slid effortlessly over my lips like a cascade of water, and I knew instantly the nervous affliction in my voice had gone back into hibernation. For that was how it had happened in the past, the debility gradually weakening until one day I opened my mouth and there was no trace of it. Mother noticed too. She said nothing more, and I trod toward the carriage house without looking back.
Handful. When dark fell, Mama started to shake. Her head lolled and her teeth clattered. It wasn't like Rosetta and her fits where all her limbs jerked. It was like Mama was cold inside her bones. I didn't know what to do but pat her arms and legs. After a while, she grew still. Her breathing drew heavy, and before I knew it, I drifted off myself. I started dreaming, and in that dream I was sleeping. I slept under an arbor of thick green. It was bent perfect over me. Vines hung round my arms. Scuppernongs fell alongside my face. I was the girl sleeping. But at the same time, I could see myself, like I was part of the clouds floating by, and then I looked down and saw the arbor wasn't really an arbor. It was a quilt frame covered in vines and leaves. I went on sleeping, watching myself sleeping, and the clouds went on floating, and I saw inside the thick grain again. This time it was Mama herself inside there. I don't know what woke me. The room was quiet, the light gone. Mama said, "You wake?" Those were the first words she'd said since Tomfrey strapped her. "I'm awake." "All right, I'm gonna tell you a story. You listening, Handful?" "I'm listening." My eyes had got used to the dark, and I saw the door still propped wide to the hallway, and Mama beside me frowning. She said, "Your granny mama come from Africa when she was a girl. About same as you now." My heart started to beat hard. It filled up my ears. Soon as she got here, her mama and daddy was taken from her, and that same night the stars fell out of the sky. You think stars don't fall? But your granny mama swore it. Mama tarried, letting us picture how the sky might have looked. She say everything round here sound like jibber-jabber to her. The food tastes like monkey meat. She ain't got nothing but this little old scrap of quilt her mama made. In Africa, her mama was a quilter, best there is. They was fawn people and sewed applique same like I do. They cut out fishes, birds, lions, elephants, every beast they had and sewed them on. But the quilt your granny mama bought with her didn't have no animals on it. just little three side shapes, what you call a triangle. Same like I put on my quilts. My mama say they was blackbird wings. The floor creaked in the hallway and I heard somebody out there breathing high and fast, the way Miss Sarah breathed. I eased up on my elbow and craned my neck. And there she was, her shadow blotted on the hall window. I lowered myself back to the mattress, and Mama went on telling her story with Miss Sarah listening in. Your granny mama got sold to some man for $20, and he put her in the fields near Georgetown. They eat boiled black-eyed peas in the morning, and if you ain't done eating in 10 minutes' time, you don't get no more that day. Your granny mama say she always eat too slow. I never did know my daddy. He was a white man named John Paul, not the master, but his brother. After I come, we got sold off. Mama say I be the fair side of brown, and everybody know what that mean. We got bought by a man near Camden. He kept Mama in the fields, and I stay out there with her. But nights, she teach me everything she know about quilts. I tore up old pant legs and dress tails and pieced them. Mama say in Africa, they sew charms in their quilts. I put pieces of my hair down inside mine. When I got 12, Mama started bragging to the Camden missus how I could sew anything. And the missus took me to the house to learn from their seamstress. I got better and she was in a hurry. She broke off and shifted her legs on the bed. I was afraid that was all she had to say. I never heard this story. Listening to it was like watching myself sleep, clouds floating, Mama bent over me. I forgot Miss Sarah was out there. I waited, and finally she started back telling. Mama birthed my brother while I was sewing in the house. She never say who his daddy was. My brother didn't live out the year. After he died, your granny mama found us a spirit tree. It's just an oak tree, but she called it a baobab like they have in Africa. She say fond people keep a spirit tree, and it always be a baobab. Your granny mama wrapped the trunk with thread she begged and stole. She took me out there and say, we gonna put our spirits in the tree so they safe from harm. We kneel on her quilt from Africa, nothing but a shred now, and we give our spirits to the tree. She say, our spirits live in the tree with the birds, learning to fly. She told me, if you leave this place, go get your spirit and take it with you. We used to gather up leaves and twigs from around the tree and stick them in pouches to wear at our necks. Her hand went to her throat like she was feeling for it. She said, Mama died of croup one winter. I was 16. I could sew anything there was. About that time, the master got in money debt and sold off every one of us. I got bought by Master Grimke for his place in Union. Night before I left, I went and got my spirit from the tree and took it with me. I want you to know your daddy was good as gold. His name was Shaney. He worked in Master Grimke's field. One day, Mrs. say I got to come sew for her in Charleston. I say, all right, but bring Shaney, he my husband. She say, Shaney a field slave, and maybe I see him sometime when I back for a visit. You was already inside me, and nobody knew. Shaney died from a cut on his leg for you a year old. He never saw your face. Mama stopped talking. She was done. She went to sleep then and left the story bent perfect over me. Next morning when I eased out of bed headed for the privy, I bumped into a basket sitting by the door. Inside it was a big bottle of liniment and some medicine tea. That day I went back to tending Miss Sarah. I slipped into her room while she was reading one of her books. She was shy to bring up what happened to Mama, so I said, we got your basket. Her face eased. Tell your mother I'm sorry for her treatment, and I hope she'll feel better soon. And it wasn't any toil in her words. That mean a lot to us, I said. She laid the book down and came where I was standing by the chimney place and put her arms round me. It was hard to know where things stood. People say love gets fouled by a difference big as ours. I didn't know for sure whether Miss Sarah's feelings came from love or guilt. I didn't know whether mine came from love or a need to be safe. She loved me and pitied me, and I loved her and used her. It never was a simple thing. That day our hearts were pure as they ever would get.
Sarah. Spring turned to summer, and when Madame Ruffin suspended classes until the fall, I asked Thomas to expend our private lessons on the piazza.
I'm afraid we have to stop them altogether, he said. I have my own studies to consider. Father has ordered me to undertake a systematic study of his law books in preparation for Yale.
I could help you, I cried.
Sarah, Sarah, quite contrera.
It was the phrase he used when his refusal was foregone and final. He had no idea the extent I'd enmeshed him in my plans. There was a string of barrister firms on Broad Street, from the Exchange to St. Michael's, and I pictured the two of us partnered in one of them with a signboard out front. Grimke and Grimke. Of course, there would be an out-and-out skirmish with the rank and file, but with Thomas at my side and Father at my back, nothing would prevent it. I bore down on Father's law books every afternoon myself. In the mornings, I read aloud to Hetty in my room with the door bolted. When the air cooked to unbearable degrees, we escaped to the piazza. And there, sitting side by side in the swing, we sang songs that Hetty composed, most of them about traveling across water by boat or whale. Her legs swung back and forth like little batons. Sometimes we sat before the windows in the second floor alcove and played Lace the String. Hetty always seemed to have a stash of red thread in her dress pocket, and we spent hours passing it through our upstretched fingers, creating intricate, bloodshot mazes in the air. Such occupations are what girls do together, but it was the first occasion for either of us, and we carried them out as covertly as possible to avoid Mother putting an end to them. We were crossing a dangerous line, Hetty and I. One morning, while Charleston turned miserably on the brazier of summer, Hetty and I lay flat on our stomachs on the rug in my room while I read aloud from Don Quixote. The week before, Mother had ordered the mosquito nettings out of storage and affixed above the beds in anticipation of the blood-sucking season. But having no such protection, the slaves were already scratching and clawing at their skin. They rubbed themselves with lard and molasses to draw out the itch, and trailed its eau de cologne through the house. Hetty dug at an inflamed mosquito bite on her forearm and frowned at the book pages as if they were some kind of irresolvable code. I wanted her to listen to the exploits of the knight and Sancho Panza, but she interrupted me repeatedly, placing her finger on some word or other, asking, "What does that one say?" And I would have to break off the story to tell her. She'd done the same thing recently as we read The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe of York, and I wondered if, perhaps, she was merely bored with the antics of men, from the shipwrecked to the chivalrous. As I sent my voice into dramatic lilts and accents, trying to lure her back into the tale, the room grew dark, tinctured with an approaching storm. Wind blew through the open window, coming thick with the smell of rain and oleander, swirling the veils of the mosquito net. I stopped reading as thunder broke and rain splattered across the sill. Hetty and I leapt up in unison and drew down the pane. And there, swooping low in the yellow gloom, was the young owl that Charlotte and Hetty had fed faithfully through the spring. It had grown out of its fledgling ways, but it had not vacated its residence in the woodpile. I watched it fly straight toward us, arcing across George Street and gliding over the workyard wall, its comical barn owl face strikingly visible. As the bird disappeared, Hetty went to light the lamp, but I was fixed there. What came to me was the day at the woodpile when Charlotte first showed me the bird, and I remembered the oath I'd made to help Hetty become free.
a promise impossible to fulfill, and one that continued to cause me no end of guilt. But it suddenly rang clear in me for the first time. Charlotte said I should help Hetty get free any way I could. Turning, I watched her carry the lantern to my dressing table, light swirling about her feet. When she set it down, I said, "Hetty, shall I teach you to read?" Equipped with an elementary primer, two blueback spellers, a slate board, and a lump of chalk, we began daily lessons in my room. Not only did I lock the door, I screened the keyhole. Our tutorials went on throughout the morning for 2 or more hours. When we ended them, I wrapped the materials in a swath of coarse cloth, known as Negro cloth, and tucked the bundle beneath my bed.